Good evening, you guys. I'm KQ Romeo, India Whiskey. You've been to the right button first, yeah. KQ Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And it's time we start the TechNet. That's been done for 35 years and 1 month. Started September of 1982. 35 years ago. Kind of amazing. As you guys already know, main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who want to discuss and find out more about how wireless equipment works, and radio in particular. But we also get into many other subjects of interest to ham radio operators, which includes science and physics, like things. Roy KAC2GS 3 weeks ago started a section of the TechNet on the subject of science and physics, and it's been reasonably well received. So we're going to continue that. Let me drop. And an awful lot of what the TechNet is what you guys are suggesting. Sometimes we have interesting TechNet, sometimes a little bit more boring. The difference is whether or not you guys ask interesting questions. The majority of what's discussed is a subject that you bring before the TechNet. An awful lot of what takes place on the TechNet, the individual sections, so to speak, are things that were suggested by the audience that they like and want to continue. So the science and physics section is something we'll probably continue, unless a whole lot of people complain about it, which I kind of doubt. So it's your show. Ask not what the TechNet can supply to you as entertainment, ask what you can supply to the TechNet as good questions and good suggestions. To misquote a Kennedy quote from way back when. There also was this weekend a ham fest at the Levittown Hall, and some of the guys picked up some real good bargains. We're going to hear about those if they feel like discussing them with providing them to us. If a person does have a question or a comment for the TechNet, you're going to sign in by giving me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. Your great big long list of names of people who are listening doesn't really supply useful information per se. After 35 years and 1 month, there's a good reason to believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So, please give me your call letters, name, and the word yes at this time. And in between each one of the signs, please wait for the four beeps to make sure we don't time out the machine. K2RIW, TechNet, Limark, we're listening.
WA2RIY, Joe, yes.
Hey, we got you, Joe. Anyone else? Anybody with any questions or comments for the TechNet? Please give me your call letters at this time. And then KQRIW.
And WS2N, Paul is here for a space report.
And I bet you that's going to be space report number 274. Let's see if I got the number right here. 274 of the series. That began 274 weeks ago, roughly. One last call. Anybody with any questions or comments for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, Joe. You're not only number one on the runway, you're the only one that signed in. So I hope you got a nice, long, juicy question for us tonight. End or statement. W-H-R-I-Y. K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Joe.
Oh, I absolutely have a good one for you. I think you've covered this subject before, but it's like any other subject. When it's a good one, sometimes it's worth bringing up again, and even again sometimes. This subject has to do with converting VSWR to return loss and converting return loss to VSWR, because some people like measuring one way and some people like measuring the other way. And it's always a good idea to know how to take one level of reading and convert it to the other form of measurement. Back to you, Dick.
Yes, any weight ratio is almost always a good subject. Highly misunderstood. Intimately related to antenna performance, antenna tuning accuracy. And so therefore, a very valuable piece of information because many of our modern day no-tune rigs start misbehaving. If the standing wave ratio is any higher than about 1.5 to 1, some of them will tolerate a lot higher, but some of those persnickety ones will start cutting back power or turn off the final stage entirely if the standing wave ratio exceeds 1.5 to 1. Reflective power ratio and standing wave ratio are related by the fact that a transmission line is a very persnickety thing. The good news about a transmission line is it allows you to have the transmitter and the antenna very far apart from each other. In the early days of ham radio, the guy would operate the shack in the attic of the house. The house was wooden. He would set his transmitter in the middle of a wooden table, and the dipole antenna, half of it went from the transmitter out the eastern window, the other half of it went out the western window of the house, and the transmitter sat in the middle. Well, eventually, we ham radio operators got relegated to the basement instead of the attic. And now the transmitter is a much longer distance from the antenna. So a transmission line is required. The transmission line takes that power out of your transmitter, conveys it hopefully with very low loss, and brings it up to the antenna. Good job. The good news is that a good transmission line, properly used, can convey the power there very efficiently. The bad news is the transmission line is persnickety. If the transmission line has this crazy quality called characteristic impedance, and if it's, say, 50 ohms, then that transmission line wants to be terminated with a pure 50 ohm resistor. Anything other than a 50 ohm resistor, a certain percentage of the power that you send up the transmission line to the antenna goes into the antenna and doesn't stay there. It reflects back down. There is no reflection at exactly 50 ohms, but any amount of reactance starts making the reflective power go up real fast. Any error in the resistance, 49 ohms or 51 ohms instead of 50, very slowly starts reflecting some power. Reactance does it much more rapidly. The reflective power ratio is what's often referred to by the a decibel number. If you had a real high standing wave ratio, like 5.8 to 1, where half of your power would be reflected, half of the power reflected, expressed as a decibel, is minus 3 dB. So you'd have a reflected power ratio of half power, and you're running 100 watts, the bird route meter would run, would read 50 watts going in the wrong direction, or you would have, if you convert it to decibels, it would be minus 3 dB. 3 dB reflective power ratio would be half power reflected, 5.8 standing wave ratio. Rounding up the numbers a little bit. Any drop? Now, standing wave ratio, often called VSWR, VSWR, is a voltage standing wave ratio, not power standing wave ratio. You could come up with a factor called power standing wave ratio. It would be very non-traditional. People would know what you're talking about. Voltage standing wave ratio. You'd have to convert the reflected power into a voltage ratio in order to calculate standing wave ratio. In the example I just gave, half power being reflected back, 3 dB reflected, you'd have to convert the reflected power into a voltage. You know that the power is a function of E squared over R, where R is 50 ohms. So the square of the voltage creates an amount of power into a resistor. Not a linear relationship. You double the voltage, you've got the double squared is 4. You've got 4 times as much power when you double voltage. So you've got to convert the number, reflect the power ratio, into a voltage before you can calculate standing wave ratio. Half power, which means that you're taking the square root of 0.5 inverting standing wave ratio. So the voltage reflection coefficient is the square root of the power ratio. Let me drop. And another crazy characteristic required to calculate standing wave ratio is it's got to be a number greater than 1. So you take the 0.707 that I just gave you for a voltage reflection ratio. You first add it to 1, put that in the numerator. You subtract it from 1 and put it in the denominator. That reflected voltage ratio is quite often represented by the Greek letter rho. So standing wave ratio equals 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho. So step-by-step process, you first convert your power ratio into a voltage by taking the square root. That's called rho, 1 plus rho divided by 1 minus rho. That's standing wave ratio. And if you did that, 1.707 on top and 1 minus 0.707 on the bottom, you'd end up with 5.8 to 1 standing wave ratio, roughly, round numbers, in that particular example. We drop. As you can tell, we've done it as a three-step process. What ratio of power is reflected? Take the square root of that to convert it to rho. 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho is standing wave ratio. You could, if you want to, do it in all one step by making a more complicated formula. I don't recommend that. It makes it more difficult to memorize and not make any mistakes when you remember it with some errors. To know what's really going on, that any imperfection in the load that the transmission line sees is going to create some reflected power. That reflected power converted to a voltage is rho, 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho, standing wave ratio. Let me drop. Now, if you've got the standing wave ratio and you want to reverse the process, you want to convert it back into voltage reflection ratio and or power ratio, you call the VSWR, let's call it S, just to give it a symbol. S is the standing wave ratio, 5.8 to 1 is the example I just gave you. 5.8 would be the S. And to create the voltage ratio, it's now S minus 1 divided by S plus 1. S minus 1 over S plus 1. So it would be 5.8 minus 1, 4.8, over 4.8 plus 1, which would be 6.8. Now that's going to give you the 0.707. When you use the right numbers, I'm using rounded off numbers. That's the voltage reflection coefficient. That's the first step in going backwards. And then if you want that converted into power, you take that number and square it. Because power is voltage squared over R, E squared over R. So knowing what's going on is more valuable than memorizing a formula, in my opinion. Knowing that a certain ratio of power is reflected, and now you know what to do with it to convert it into a standing wave ratio. Let me drop. And if you've got a standing wave ratio and you want to know what amount of power is being reflected or what the voltage reflection coefficient ratio is, you could take the forward process that you've written down as multiple steps and now just simply reverse those steps, go back up the list on your page, if you know what I mean. Standing wave ratio is a traditional phenomenon. Like, where in the world did it come from? All modern test equipment, a third wattmeter measuring forward and reverse power, measures power ratio very conveniently. That slug on your bird wattmeter is a beautiful directional coupler. When the slug is in the forward direction, it is sampling the amount of power going forward. You rotate the plug 180 degrees, and it now measures power going in the reverse direction. So the machine measures power forward and reverse ratio, or the exact numbers. It does it very well. Bird wattmeter. Let me drop this. The next step up in elaborate modern-day instrumentation is a vector network analyzer. Back in the old days, what an engineer would have to do is he runs around the lab, gets the right kind of a signal generator covering the frequency he wants. He then goes and finds a Wheatstone bridge or a directional coupler.
She then goes and gets a crystal detector or a power meter, and or maybe an oscilloscope. He goes and gets those individual pieces of instrumentation, sets them up on the lab bench along with the device of the test, sends some signal down a transmission line from the signal generator through the directional coupler or through the Wheatstone bridge into the device of the test, and on the directional coupler port of the coupler or on the coupled port of the Wheatstone bridge, either with a crystal detector or a power meter, he measures some amount of power being reflected. And in order to calibrate the instrument, he's got to put on a known good 50 ohm load, and then the device of the test. But he used to have to gather all these pieces of test equipment, put them on the bench or on the shelf near the bench, above the bench, assemble it all with cables and everything else in order to make a antenna impedance measurement, standing wave ratio measurement, reflective power ratio measurement. Let me drop. Way back in the late 60s, Hewlett-Packard, among other companies, got the great idea of, gee, all these engineers, day in and day out, are gathering these equipment, setting up this exact same setup, schematically speaking, day in and day out. Why don't we put all that into one box? The signal generator, the directional coupler, the power sensing device, the indicator, and the modern-day network analyzer also has a computer in there, a microprocessor, that does all the math for you. So put all that in one box, you've got a vector network analyzer. The vector network analyzer, 99% of them operate with a mediocre directional coupler inside, very broad range, frequency-wise directional coupler. And by a 12-point calibration procedure, a view on the outside with your piece of test cable, at the end of that piece of test cable, you put an ideal 50 ohm load, an ideal open circuit, an ideal short circuit, an ideal throughput device, if you're using the two-port, two-cable testing technique to measure throughput characteristics like gain of a device on the test. You go through the calibration procedure, and the mediocre performance directional coupler is inside, is calibrated to be very high in precision, as if they had over 50 dB of directivity, even though they don't. Let me drop. So, all modern day equipment really measures power ratio or voltage ratio with either a directional coupler or something like a Wheatstone bridge. To then take, that's the real message. If the antenna was ideal, no power or no voltage gets reflected from the antenna. Every non-ideal load on the end of your transmission line is going to create some percentage of reflective power or reflective voltage.
Thank you, Adrian.
That's the real information. Then we go and encode the information into a classic thing called standing wave ratio. Let me drop. Teach you RIW here.
Thank you, radio. You're right.
Okay, it's making... It's making some funny sounds. It makes the sound stop. The fan inside needs some lubrication. So, the old-fashioned technique of standing wave ratio is now encoded message. It's not what we measure anymore. It came about because in the early days, it didn't have a directional coupler. It didn't have a vector network analyzer. It didn't have a bird well meter. All you had is an electro-wire system. Most of the transmission lines in those days was a pair of parallel wires. And by sliding a neon bulb along the wire, you found a place where the voltage was maximum, you found another place where the voltage was minimum, you either measured the voltage or the brightness of the bulb, and you directly measured the standing wave by looking at the peaks of voltage and the valleys of voltage along the transmission line. Any reflective power on a transmission line. Since some of the signal is going forward, some of the signal is coming back, there are periodic places every half wavelength along the line where the forward and the reverse voltage are in phase. You get a peak in voltage there.
Repeater, time out.
At some other point, let's see if I'm hearing that. At some other point on the cable, the two are out of phase with each other, and you get a valley of voltage. that's the voltage maximum to voltage minimum, that ratio, standing wave ratio, voltage standing wave ratio. In the old days of electric wire on open wire lines, you did measure that. You didn't have the ability to have use that to measure frequency by measuring wavelength. That's why we called it a 20 meter band, because those peaks and valleys were 10 meters apart on the 20 meter band. So I have it right here. Half wavelength between peaks, half wavelength between valleys. You measured wavelength directly, we called this a 20 meter band. You measured standing wave ratio by the interference on the transmission line. So that's the tradition of where wavelength and that standing wave ratio came from. The modern day instrumentation, we don't do it that way. So we're encoding the message to go back in history. We don't have to do that. When you teach our engineers to be used to measuring voltage ratio or power ratio or reflection, and that's the real information you want to know. But an awful lot of us got the tradition of standing wave ratio, so we got to keep that going. So that's some of the information that went before that, Joe. So H-U-R-Y-Y, again, the guy who asked the original question, H-U-R-Y-W, the tech man.
Yeah, very good, very good, very interesting discussion. It takes a while, I just got listen to open things in, but it makes a lot of sense. I remember just seeing relative ratios, like if I tell me if this sounds correct or not. Something like 1.4 VSWR is about 5% reflective power. 2-1 is like 11%, and 3-1 is something like 25%. That's what I should remember. I saw them on something called, I think it's not a RAM. I think it is like a chart that tells you percentage of power in decibels compared to VSWR. So somebody, people have calculated this out to make it a little easier, but I guess you don't have one of those. You got to sort of do it the hard way.
Yeah, you could very easily plug in a bunch of numbers, a certain amount of 10%, 5%, 20%, 30%, 50%, power ratio, voltage ratio, calculate the standing wave ratio from that, convert it to dB. If you Google the right search words, they will give you a program, or they'll give you a spreadsheet with all those numbers on it. Bird Company, in one of their manuals, has that spreadsheet. Weinschel also has that spreadsheet. So you don't have to go through all the trouble of making your own spreadsheet. Google the right question, and that spreadsheet will be hot. In front of your face on that screen, you make a hard copy of that. Tape it to the wall if you like. Or after you've studied that spreadsheet a while, and memorize some of the good numbers. Some of the good things to remember is that a 2-1 standing wave ratio, which sounds pretty bad, is only half a dB of loss in the worst case. 2-1 standing wave ratio only creates half a dB of loss in the worst case if you aren't using an antenna tuner. If you are using an antenna tuner in the shack, all the reflective power back down to the shack is being reflected forward in phase. That's what your antenna tuner does. The magic of the antenna tuner. Is that when you twist those knobs on it, if it's a manual one, and you adjust for the best of pieces match, which gives you the most amount of forward power, it just happens to be the tuning of the antenna tuner that takes all the reflective power, re-reflects it forward every bit of it, and it re-reflects it forward in phase with the power or voltage coming out of your transmitter at this time. Because of that reflection going on, whenever you're using an antenna tuner with a less than ideal antenna, some amount of power is bouncing back and forth between the shack and the antenna, which eventually gets radiated, except for the fact that some of it gets lost in the cable, because it's been through the cable multiple times, but eventually gets radiated. So you get the power bouncing back and forth, and a certain percentage of it is being radiated. Not phony. If you put a bird watt meter after your antenna tuner, and you know you're running a 100 watt transmitter, and the forward power reads 130 watts, and the reverse power reads 30 watts. that. A lot of people say that phone is not real. It's only reactive power. Not true. My opinion is as real as anything in the drone. You can put a directional coupler on that line, which is what your bird watch meter is. By knowing the calibration of the directional coupler, you will reconfirm that 130 watts may be flowing forward in that example I just did. And you could take a sample of that power, sample of 130 watts, and light a light bulb with it. That's not reactive power, that's real. So, this can be very confusing to people at first, until they realize what's going on. And a well-made antenna tuner can be lossless. There's a significant number of amateurs out there who think that the antenna tuner takes all the reflected power and throws it away. Absolutely not. Throws it away. Power cannot be created or destroyed, only changed in another form. The antenna tuner is perfectly shielded, so it can't radiate the power. If it's well made, it runs ice cold. It's not dissipating the power. Obviously, by the fact that the transmitter sees a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, it's not being reflected back through the antenna tuner into the transmitter. There's nothing left. It's not transferring the power back to the transmitter. It's not radiating it. It's not converting it into the heat. Ain't nothing left but re-reflecting it forward. By conservation of energy, there's nothing left. The B2LYY, K2LIW, go ahead, Joe.
W4LY. I have seen that effect with my antenna tuner on my airship radio. I put the watt meter after it, looking at the antenna itself, and I did see pretty much what you said. You have a lot more higher power going out in a forward direction that the meter shows than you actually really are putting out of the radio, because at the radio center, I set it to 100 watts into a dummy load and left the power level set at that point, then put it into the antenna tuner, tuned for best, reflective power as far as the radio is concerned, because it has an internal meter, and I left the bird watt meter on the output. It did pretty much show exactly what you're saying. But here's the interesting thing, continuing with this thing. You're saying the 100 watts plus the 30, you're saying like if you had 30 watts reflective power. The 100 watts plus 30, you're giving your reader a reading of 130, is really still 100 watts of radiated energy going forward. It's not 130 watts, correct?
Yes. In that particular example, with 30 watts being reflected, with 100 watts hitting the antenna, I don't know the exact number, but that's probably something like a 1.7 standing wave ratio. So, something in the vicinity of 75 or 80% of the power hitting the antenna gets radiated, the rest gets reflected. When you go through the mathematics of that, you'll find out that yes, 130 watts is going forward. A certain percentage of that, like 80% of it, is being radiated and the rest reflected. If the transmission line was lossless and the transmitter was putting out 100 watts, exactly 100 watts would be radiated. Something like 30 watts of the 130 going forward hitting the antenna, 30 of it's being reflected, but 100 is being radiated. So the whole system, antenna, transmission line, antenna tuner, transmitter, it all obeys conservation of energy once you figure out what's going on. So 100 could be radiated in that case, but 130 going forward, because it's got this constant ratio of reflection. Back to you, Joe, W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
So the antenna tuner basically is doing two things. It's letting you re-radiate the energy that's being reflected back from a bad antenna or mismatch to some point. And it's also keeping the transmitter very happy with the transmitter sees a fairly constant reflected power level coming back to the transmitter. Very good, very good. Good stuff to talk about, very interesting.
For you guys that happen to get the Microwave Journal, the October issue, year 2017, the latest issue, the October issue, has an article with a mysterious title. The title is Antenna Less wireless. Antenna-less wireless. In other words, you're transmitting signals, you're doing wireless transmission and reception without antennas, is what the article suggests. The total title is Antenna-less Wireless, a marriage between antenna and microwave engineer. It's a play on words. It would lead you to believe there's no antenna there. Absolutely not. If you're transmitting and receiving signals, the thing that's the electromagnetic transducer, the thing that launches the signal into the air, and the thing that captures the signal in the air and turns it back into a signal that the receiver can respond to, that thing is called an antenna. And let me think, or an aerial, if you want to be British, it's an aerial or an antenna. So is the antenna-less wireless equipment in this article operating without an antenna? Absolutely not. What they're talking about is that they're violating the two-wheeler technique criteria. Let me drop it. The modern-day cell phone has less and less volume in there because we insist on it being thin and got a whole lot of other stuff in there for all the other functions. Camera and global positioning, satellite receiver system and whatever. So the antenna has gotten smaller and smaller. And they got this thing in here called a antenna booster. That's their word for it. It's simply a tuning network. As you've heard me say so often, the seven most important words in the English language, if you're an antenna designer or an antenna user, so to speak, you resonate first and then it will radiate. No matter how small your antenna is, if it's made out of lossless materials, and if it is resonated, at least at that resonant frequency, it has the ability to radiate all the signal you put into it. It can be an efficient transmitter, it can be an efficient receiver, as long as it's resonant. So they've got these little boxes they're putting alongside of this tiny antenna on the printed circuit board, which they call it the antenna booster. Booster amplifier. They give all kinds of funny words. It's simply an impedance matching device. It's a resonator. So if the thing that you call radiating system, let me drop it. Radiating system consists of an antenna, a balun if you're using one, a transmission line if you're using one, an antenna tuner if you're using one, the tank circuit of the transmitter if you're using one, and the transmitter. That total radiating system must be in resonance in order to efficiently radiate. And so, do you have, in the old days, they used to think that all of the resonance had to take place in the antenna itself. Well, once we started using antenna tuners, and quarter wave and other lengths of transmission lines as impedance matching devices, we suddenly realized that once you force the total system into resonance, it will radiate. Everyone wants to believe that the signal you send into an antenna goes into the antenna and just jumps into space. Absolutely not. Radiation is hard. A signal has to be kicked in the tail 10 times in a row on average before it finally gets radiated into space. A signal bounces back and forth in your antenna roughly 10 times. That's why it's got a Q of 10. That's why it's got a finite bandwidth. There's only a certain frequency region over which all of those bounces stay in phase with each other, in step with each other. That's what resonance is. All the bounces staying in step. Co-phase. Let me drop. And the advantage of all of the steps, all of the bounces being co-phase and in step is that in the case of a 10 to 1 ratio antenna, a Q of 10, is that somewhere in the middle of that antenna, the current is 10 times higher than the current you've launched into the antenna with your transmission line. The current is 10 times higher. Somewhere else in the antenna, the voltage is 10 times higher. The Q of 10 has got about five definitions. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle, center frequency divided by bandwidth, rise time and fall time. All of these are different ways of expressing the exact same phenomenon. Signal is bouncing back and forth, hopefully all in step, all the bounces. And so the advantage of the Q of 10 antenna, the typical dipole, it's got a Q of 10. The current somewhere in the dipole is 10 times higher. That means somewhere in the dipole, the current is 10 times, the magnetic field created by the current is 10 times stronger. And there were some people who believe that the magnetic field is what really launches the wave into space. If you study the inner workings of many of the antenna modeling programs, many of them calculate where's the maximum current, or where what's the distribution of current along the wire of the dipole. That gives you a distribution of magnetic fields, and then it calculates each little piece of that magnetic field by the law of superposition adds up somewhere in space to give you an antenna pattern. So many of the programs calculate the magnetic field and calculate the antenna pattern and the gain accordingly. It may not be the whole story, but the program works very well most of the time.
Repeater, time out.
So these guys were not smart enough to realize that this thing that they're calling an antenna booster is simply the resonator. They haven't yet put it all together in this article to realize that they're resonating this infinitesimal antenna. In some of the cases of the example they gave, the antenna is a 50th of a wavelength, in one case, a 70th of a wavelength in length. The tiny little chip on the printed circuit board of the cell phone, the antenna radiator is a 50th of a wavelength long. As long as you resonate that, it works like a charm, as long as it's made out of low loss material. And so the antenna inside your cell phone can cover all of those Wi-Fi frequencies, all of those individual bands. There's an 800 megacycle band and a 1900 megacycle band and a 2100 megacycle band and so on. The antenna can radiate in all of those bands as long as you can force it into resonance. So almost all of the antennas that are inside of our cell phones, right alongside of that antenna, there is an integrated circuit chip that is the antenna tuner to resonate that antenna. The early days of cell phones used to have a little whip sticking out of the top. They didn't need that anymore now that they've gotten smart enough to know how to resonate the antenna with an integrated circuit chip right alongside of the antenna. It's now buried inside of that whole package. You don't see the antenna. You could call it the antennaless wireless if you like, but there's an antenna there. It's just, they're playing with words, in my opinion, in this article. Reasonably well-written article, but you got to read it with some of this additional understanding, in my opinion. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, H-U-R-I-W-J-H-O.
I can attest to what you said about voltage and current on an antenna being 10 times, maybe not, I don't know, measurable, but quite a bit higher than you would expect. I'll give you an example. In my younger days, working for one particular radio shop, they had some customers on around 37 and change megahertz, and some vehicles used long ball-mount quarter-wave whips on the vehicles, and sometimes the sedans had loaded antennas on the vehicle. Well, the radios they used were 100-watt radios. One day I decided, well, that was just, I guess it's a dumb thing to do. But I put my hand on the ball mount, grabbed it with my hand on the spring and the ball mount, and transmitted it. You could feel a current in your hand start to heat up your hand. And then I tried the same experiment with the loaded antenna, and I guess I wasn't touching the metal, and I really couldn't feel the current. But when I moved my hand up to the top of the antenna, the very tip, and this loaded antenna maybe had a 47, 48-inch rod on the end of the loading coil, well, I drew about a quarter-inch spark to my finger and put a little burn hole in it. So I learned my lesson. But what you say is definitely true.
On that probably quarter-wave whip antenna you're describing, the current at the base is usually the place where the current is maximum, and that current at the base was probably 10 times higher than the current coming out of the transmission line. The tip of the antenna at the top is where the voltage is maximum. The voltage probably there was 10 times higher than the voltage coming out of the transmission line. So the Q of 10, approximately, on that whip antenna, the 10 equals the voltage rise at resonance, the current rise at 10 at resonance, and so on. The center frequency divided by the bandwidth, a relationship to giving you the rise time and the fall time. You could also calculate the energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. There are five different definitions of Q, but they're all related to the exact same phenomenon: resonating signal bouncing back and forth in the antenna. Now, you could, if you want to, do a beautiful science experiment. You could take a piece of semi-rigid cable or a piece of RG58, for instance, make a very small loop at the end, maybe 1-inch diameter, at your VHF frequency and take the center conductor and fold it back in that loop and ground it to the shield. So you've now got a small loop at the end of a transmission line. If you now hold that loop so that the plane of the loop is in the plane of the wire radiator of that antenna, there are ways of calibrating that loop by knowing the distance the loop is from the radiating monopole, the ground plane antenna, knowing the diameter of the loop and the amount of voltage it picks up. That loop is a non-directional coupler. It's measuring the magnetic field at the base of the antenna. The magnetic field into the loop of your sampling loop creates
repeater timeout.
The magnetic field at the base of the antenna creates a certain amount of magnetic field. The magnetic field lines, which are wrapped around the monopole antenna, very similar to you putting your hands around the antenna. Your fingers wrapping around the antenna represent the direction of the magnetic field. Your thumb represents the direction of the current, at least in one half of the cycle, so to speak. And that magnetic field going through your loop could be calibrated by you can set up a network of a piece of wire parallel to a ground plane where you put a known amount of current through it, hold your loop near that piece of wire, and measure at a given distance how many volts you pick up, so you can calibrate that system. So by calibrating that system, that current measuring sampling loop, you can find that with a couple of percent accuracy easily exactly how much RF current is flowing into the ground plane antenna. Or you could open up the thing and put a real current meter in there, but you'd be disturbing the thing when you did that. In the old days, they used to have a hot wire type RF ammeter. And there's also a iron vein type. There's various kinds of old-fashioned RF ammeters that you could put in the system. But the in vitro test of putting a sampling loop nearby would allow you to measure the current. By a similar technique, let me drop. You can make another sampling device where the piece of RG58 cable, for instance, center conductor, sticks out of the shield by a small, let's say a half an inch. At the end of that, you put a small metallic ball just to make sure there isn't a sharp point creating an arc. And now you hold that at a given distance from the tip of the ground plane antenna and measure the amount of voltage you pick up. And that also can be calibrated. You put a sampling port in the middle of your dummy load, and you put this device in that sampling port where you know how many watts you're putting into a 50-ohm dummy load. You know how many volts are there. And at a given distance, your voltage sampling device picks up a certain percentage of that voltage. So with very simple techniques where you can calibrate and test, you could actually measure the amount of RF voltage at the tip of the antenna, and you could measure the amount of RF current at the base of the antenna. And you would find that it's roughly a 10-to-1 ratio if it had a Q of 10. And many ground plane antennas and many dipoles have a Q of 10. If you start making the antenna infinitesimal in size and re-resonating it, you can easily have the Q go up as high as 100. 100 times more current and 100 times more voltage. And 100 times less bandwidth. Or 10 times less bandwidth. It's all related to the Q. So there's many further experiments. You did a very rough experiment by putting your hand on that spring and measuring the heat. And now, was the heat RF heating of the protoplasm of your hand, or was the heat because the wire of the spring itself was getting hot? It would take another experiment to run the antenna. Let me drop. Run the antenna for a given length of time and measure how much the spring heats up, versus holding your hand on the spring and measure how much heat you get. And I think the second experiment would be a greater amount of heat. So that RF current flowing through that spring was also creating a microwave heating of your hand, if you know what I mean. A microwave oven-like heating of your hand. It's a B2RYY. We've got an irradiated hand. K2RIW in the TechNet.
of HYY. I know it was definitely not the spring heating up. It was my hand being warmed up by the RF radiation because I let go of the transmitter, and, you know, you can feel the heat go away very quickly. Then I keyed up without touching the spring for the same amount of time, unkeyed the transmitter, and as soon as I unkeyed the transmitter, touched the loading spring, not the loading spring, the actual spring itself. You got to understand, a quarter wave has typically, they're like about 4, 5, 6 feet, 6, 7 feet long at 30-some megahertz, and they have a spring, so you'll whack the antenna, it'll go back and forth. That spring was ice cold, so I was the thing being heated up, not the spring.
That makes a lot of sense, Joe, because if they did a good job in the design of the antenna, they made the spring out of materials that are highly conductive. Or maybe the spring itself was made out of a spring steel, but then was coated with copper or some other conductive material. Spring steel is not a very good RF conductor. Steel is, at radio frequencies with skin effects, steel is relatively lossy. But copper, covering it, electroplating copper on it, maybe the spring had copper or zinc or silver, and then painted. So it was covered with something. So spring was probably made out of low loss materials. You'd hate to have 50% of the power you're putting into the antenna turn into heat because of a poorly designed spring at the bottom that protects the antenna from hitting trees. So the fact that it would run essentially ice cold under RF conditions makes a lot of sense. Therefore, all the heating you sense was microwave heat of your hands. A number of people over the years have done an experiment like that directly or indirectly, like sitting on a handy talkie, and it was the rubber duck was against their leg, and they sensed that something was wrong because their leg started getting hot. And they would call me up and say, am I going to get cancer because I've done that to my leg? The answer is absolutely not. RF energy, 99.9% of what RF energy does when it hits a human being, if it gets absorbed, it gets turned into heat. And does the RF energy directly disturb your DNA and create cancer? Very, very unlikely. Now, the portion of your body that's been heated, as you start raising that portion of the body some number of degrees Fahrenheit, could that increase the risk of that portion of the body at some time getting cancer? There's a
repeater, timeout.
There's a very small increase in risk along those lines. So people who are positive that holding a cell phone against your head is going to create brain tumors. And they've been looking for that data now for 20, 30 years. Essentially, it's not there. That cell phone against your head probably creates a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit of heating if you're a long talker. And if you happen to be operating a cell phone very far away from a cell site where it, in its power management philosophy, goes to high power in order to be able to talk to the cell site. So how much power comes out of your cell phone is strongly affected by how close are you to the nearest cell site, because it adjusts the power accordingly, both to save the battery and to also have the ability to reuse that frequency 2 or 3 cell sites away. So the whole thing is a power managed system. And the magic of a cell site, cell phone, is that all the experiments to date apply that it's safe. The average person is positive. Living near a cell site is dangerous, but using the cell phone is, most people believe, is not dangerous. Because of the distance of the cell phone to your head, 1/8 of an inch, 1/4 of an inch, versus the nearest cell site that could be near your house, more than 200 feet away, because of the inverse square law, the amount of RF energy getting into your head from the cell phone is 1 million times stronger than the amount of RF energy that would get into your head if you lived directly next door to the cell site and on the second floor of your house with the bedroom window that faces directly to the cell site. You put your body in that window and make a measurement. And after you make that measurement, you get on your cell phone and tell you...
Repeater, timeout.
After you make that measurement, you get on your cell phone and tell your buddy what you measured. And if you re-measured while you're making the cell phone call, Well, in that particular case, most likely your cell phone would be using the cell site that's nearby, 200 feet away, and go down to minimum power, which is a fraction of a milliwatt. But even in that case, because of the quarter-inch distance versus 200 feet, which is a huge ratio, the amount of RF energy getting into your body from the cell phone, in general, is a million times greater. And the question quite often people ask is, what's the dangerous distance from the cell site? And the answer is you're safe at 5 feet. If you're on top of the local fire department's hook and ladder, and you're at the 100-foot level on the ladder, at the 100-foot level of the cell site antenna, and you make the measurement at drive time, at 5 o'clock at night, when everyone's on their cell phone, the cell site is being used maximum capability. You go through the mathematics, you'll find out when you're 5 feet from that antenna, at its altitude, you haven't yet exceeded the maximum permitted exposure by the U.S. standard. Less than 5 feet, yes, you're pushing your luck. But there are people who live a quarter of a mile away and they think they're in danger. They really misunderstand the mathematics. A number of zoning boards have said that you can't operate a new installation of a cell site any closer than 500 feet to a place of residence, a place of worship, or a schoolyard. Where did the number 500 feet come from? It's a rabbit hat trick. The real number is 5 feet. Over to you, Joe, for any further comments on all the above. Drag your feet in case anyone else wants to ask some more questions or make some comments on the crazy set of subjects that I think we're on. Tape 8-2-L-Y-Y.
Repeater, timeout.
Tape 8-2-L-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Yeah, I'm going to make a comment. First thing, I'm going to make a comment about the spring. The quarter wave spring used on a ball mount type of arrangement, I'm sure you've seen them used on fire vehicles and some other utility vehicles that use low band stuff. They typically have braid going from the inside, from the top to bottom. They don't necessarily completely rely on the spring itself. But the funny thing is, I don't remember seeing that on a smaller variety of springs used on some mobile antennas that are the loaded antennas. Now, the second thing about what you talk about, cellular subject, I can tell you talk about that because I used to work with two different carriers years ago. My phone I currently have has a, the network information available on it. If I bring it up on a menu, it was, you know, by purpose I turned it on so I could see the, single level DBM and DBM channel number I'm on and so forth. It tells me other variety things as far as the power of the phone itself. That's called dynamic power control, what you're talking about. That whole subject is used in both directions, on the forward side and the reverse side. If I make a call on it, this I'm talking about on GSM system, that's what my phone is on, which operates about 1930 to 1990 megahertz in a frequency range. If I see on a setup channel or data channel, or just looking at the carrier for one particular sector, from one particular sector, let me reset. For one particular sector, if I see a static reading of, say, minus 45 to minus 55 being close, fairly close to cell site, and I have one near me that I've done this with, if I go and make a call, my phone will step down about 8 to 10 to 12 steps in the phone. The GSM phone I have is a Nokia 6190. I believe they have a power level at full power of 1 watt, and each step that the phone steps down in mobile power is two decibels. So if it goes down 8, 10, or 12, you can figure it's anywhere from like 16 to 24 decibels down from its normal 1 watt power. So it does go down significantly from its normal power. And if the people knew how that really works, they would probably let people put up these carriers, put up more cell sites, because the closer you are to the cell site, the less power your phone runs, and the battery lasts a hell of a lot longer.
So living in a cluster of cell sites is safer and more convenient as far as battery life is concerned. There's a lot of misunderstanding here. And one of the recent issues of, I forget what magazine it is, a person has some micro cell sites installed on top of the local utility pole that's out in front of their property, and they're suing the town for letting the cell site do that. Everybody wants to have good cell site cell phone coverage. They don't want any dropouts, but they don't want any of the antennas near them, not in my backyard. That's a huge conflict of interest and a strong misunderstanding of the physics. A tiny little antenna on the utility pole, is that creating a great big ugly device in your neighborhood that's going to affect your property values and affect your health? The lawsuit tries to say all that. The Communication Act of 1996 of the FCC basically says you cannot deny the siting of a cell site based on the perceived risk of a radio frequency biohazard. That's been studied now for a large number of years by a large number of organizations. And so there is no confirmed biological hazard from a cell site. You can't use that as a reason to deny a cell site application. Okay, anybody with any further questions or comments on this subject, give us your call letters right now. If not, Joey's going to pick up with some final comments. W2RYY with a pause. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Yeah, one last thing about cellular. It's something I heard from quite a while ago. I think you probably heard the same story. It involves the town of Muttontown. And I know they did this to a couple of different carriers, including the one I work for, which is T-Mobile. Somebody got real tiffy about something, and they decided to stop the introduction of cell antennas on poles, because T-Mobile was putting the stuff on poles in some locations, because you really couldn't get the property rights to go put up a monopole someplace. So they just put the stuff on the LAPIS telephone poles and put the antennas on top. I think it's also happened with some of the other carriers too, possibly. And they had a thing where they had to start actually taking the stuff down, or we weren't permitted to go on the property, go up on the pole and actually service thing. If we were caught doing it, they could actually technically arrest you. So if the thing broke, it just went off the air and stayed that way. But I heard something later on that I'm not sure which carrier it was, possibly might have been Verizon or even Sprint, of them not being allowed to put up stuff in the Muttontown Township area. And somebody tried to bring one of these carriers to court and sue them because of poor coverage. And I believe the end result was the judge threw the case right clean out of court, saying, on one hand, you're telling us, we don't want cell towers, we don't want this, we don't want that, we want all the antennas taken down. And on the other hand, you're going to bring a case in court and try to sue the carrier for poor coverage, and threw the case right out of court. It's so funny. It is probably very believable that it happened.
Out in the town of Ronkonkoma, where Paul lives, WS2N, 6 months ago, there was a big to-do about cell sites being put on top of the transmission line towers, the ones that are 150 foot high, carrying these 100 kilovolt wires. So cell sites are being put on top of those towers out there. And the community was very unhappy about it. There was a great big meeting at town hall. I attended that meeting. And a fairly well-organized group of people in the community have been fighting those cell sites. And from their point of view, there was a huge biohazard, and that it was affecting their property values accordingly. They're not going to be able to sell their house. They don't want to live there because they're going to get cancer. As I said, the community was very well-organized. They had done a bunch of web searches, and the good news about the World Wide Web is there's a lot of information there. The bad news is that nobody is acting as the policeman, telling you which information is good, which information is bad. I mean, you have to you do enough of a web search, you'll find a number of articles that are very poorly documented. My people are positive that every exposure is an overexposure when it comes to RF energy.